Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking law, order, and public safety with Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski. He is answering our questions and yours. Lines are open. We'll take as many phone calls as we can, as usual. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Chief Stawinski, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a privilege as always to be with you.
Let's first talk about this accident that happened just outside of Duval High School last week. From the reporting and the information that we received during the press conference that you participated in, the county executive and the interim school CEO, 5 high school students, 2 in the front, 3 in the back, not one of them was wearing seat belts, and there was another car that hit them. How am I doing so far? Tell me what happened with that.
So the students were traveling back towards Duval, as you described, 2 in the front seat, 3 in the back. Now, our investigation is suggesting that they were traveling a little too quickly, but the principal issue was that a vehicle from an adjoining street came in and collided with them. At that point, the vehicle went into a spin and ended up in oncoming traffic, and there was a head-on collision. The occupants of that vehicle were seat-belted. It was a 74-year-old woman and a 3-year-old child. They sustained no substantive injuries, but they were taken to be checked out nonetheless. The problem was that the 3 young people in the back, as that car went into a spin, the force of the spin ejected them partially, and they sustained some pretty serious injuries. Now, to update the community, the 2 that were most seriously injured remain in the hospital. They are in critical condition, but they are stable, and they are expected. We are cautiously optimistic that they will both survive and have a full recovery, but it is still early in the healing process for them. The others were checked out, treated, released, and are doing well.
So there are 2 in the hospital still. 3 of those students have been released since this accident.
Yes.
Okay. This is the most recent of a really difficult vehicular incidents on the street. A month or so ago, there was the incident on 301.
Yes, there was.
And, multiple deaths in that. Any update, first of all, on the driver and whether or not you can confirm that she was drunk?
So I can't confirm that at this point. And let's be clear, that collision that you're speaking about occurred on 301, which is the primary responsibility of our Maryland State Police. So their crash team handled that collision. There are, as I understand it, 6 fatalities now associated with that. The concern that you have raised, and this is something that the county executive, Angela Alsobrooks, and I had a long conversation about at the beginning of the year in the wake of what occurred in December. So I offered some statistics earlier in the year. I think you've probably heard them. But briefly for the audience, in 2016, along 210 alone, okay, we made 3,600 traffic stops. The following year, we made 5,600. The following year, we made 6,400. That's in 2018. And then so far this year, as of today, we've made more than 3,000 traffic stops already. And we're only a quarter of the way into the year. The troubling part, to answer your concern, is that the number of collisions remains pretty much the same, despite the fact that we're doing more and more enforcement. When we had the single fatal collision we had on 210 so far this year, I traveled to that scene as I traveled to the homicide and the fatal collision scenes. You've seen me do that. I traveled past 3 different speed enforcement cameras. I traveled past 2 different speed monitoring trailers. I traveled past more than a dozen signs. And the thing that I would like my community to be thoughtful about is that a lot of what I'm seeing on 210 is driving behavior that is as a result of traveling along 295 or 495. Okay, these are roads that are built for that kind of volume and that kind of speed. And 210 has become by default an artery for folks traveling into D.C., back home from D.C., into South Prince George's County or into our neighbor to the south. But the driving behavior doesn't change once you hit 210. And there's no place for a car to go. And that's where I very much appreciate the efforts of Ms. Alsa Brooks and her work with the state to accelerate the development of better traffic infrastructure in South County. But let's also say this. Prince George's County as a community has been growing over the last several years. Our population has been steadily increasing. Crime continues to fall. Now, in the last couple of years, we had in, for instance, 2017, we had 6 collisions with 8 fatalities. Mm-hmm. In 2018, we had 3 collisions with 5 fatalities. And fortunately, so far we've only had 1 with 1. So what we're seeing, coming back to your original question about the DeVal students, we're seeing these collisions resulting in multiple fatalities. So the number of fatal collisions is actually coming down, but the number of fatalities in those collisions is going up.
Yeah.
And that's where I want to talk to the community. Don't rely on that airbag. That airbag is going to be an assistance, but it's not going to keep you, particularly in this dynamic that we talked about where that vehicle goes into motion, right? Those forces, you can't overcome those forces. Right, you're going to be thrown around that car. Don't be fooled into thinking that your speed has something to do with the seriousness of your injury. One of our officers was killed in a collision. He was traveling at 35 miles an hour mm-hmm. when he had that collision,
yeah.
right,
mm-hmm.
Tommy Jensen. So speed isn't the factor. It's what you might come into contact with. And remember, in that vehicle, you are not attached unless you're wearing that seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
And so while that vehicle may be traveling at, let's say, just 55 miles an hour, once that vehicle collides with something and it's coming to a stop very quickly, rapidly, you're still traveling at 55 until you come into contact with something.
A steering wheel, windshield, door, what have you.
That seatbelt is going to stop that. And then the other thing is a mechanism of injury is you have to understand that both your brain and your internal organs, right, they're not going to respond the same way either. They're going to continue. And what we see a lot of these injuries, you talk about your concussions, your contrecoup injuries, your serious internal injuries are as a result of your organs or your brain. Now, once your head comes into contact, to use your example of that windshield, now your brain is coming into contact with the inside of your
the same speed,
skull.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the airbags can prevent and mitigate, but the seatbelt is what prevents your body, right? It's a better thing to be restrained in that kind of force than to be stopped as you're traveling forward with that kind mm-hmm. of force. And that's why seatbelts are just so important. And again, I think one of the misconceptions is people are looking at those airbags and they're saying, oh, the airbag will serve that purpose if it happens. You're not going to see it coming. This is something I've been very clear with my officers. We've been doing Arrive Alive now, focusing on the importance of arriving at these calls for service safely. You're not going to see it coming. You're not going to have time to react. And please, 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 put the device down.
Yeah.
On the way over here, I saw it again, and Jennifer Donlan was fussing. He said, put the device down. It only takes a second,
yeah.
right? And when you're traveling at these kinds of speeds, it's only a second or two, but you've traveled 20, 30, 50 yards, right? And what might be coming back full circle to where we started with DeVal is at those velocities in that quick a time frame, you're not going to have time to respond to that vehicle that pops out. It's going to collide with you, and then if you don't have the seatbelt on, those forces take over. You can be ejected or you can be seriously injured in the car if you're not belted in.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski about safety on the roads and safety in your community. If you have a comment or a question for the chief, of course, we are here until 8 o'clock. We are taking all of your questions. So again, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to talk about the other big story from last month, the story about Julian Everett. He was arrested, accused of sexually assaulting two, Howard University students, also accused in 2005 of sexually assaulting a high school age girl and suspected of doing the same to other young women and or girls. Kind of refresh our listeners, because this is a really complicated but also very scary case for any young woman or parent. Explain what you believe his tactics were.
Harold, it's a extraordinarily troubling case for a couple of different reasons. Number one, his ability to adopt a persona that would lead young women to engage with him, and his ability to manipulate technology and these social websites to elicit those sort of responses. Now, the Howard University community and Prince George's County have a unique relationship, and this was of deep concern to us immediately once we saw this thing evolving. It came to us, to give you a little bit of background, in an anonymous letter that we received in the beginning of 2018. And our detectives immediately set about the work of assessing that anonymous tip and coming to a place where we could begin to work through. We had some investigative leads that led us to the two victims that were Howard University students. But I want to be clear. Howard University is not affiliated with Julian Everett, and Julian Everett is not affiliated with Howard University. He adopted this persona that would lead people to conclude that he was integral to the university community, but he was not.
He pretended to be a student.
He pretended to be a student here. He did pose as a student or a younger person in other places as well. But Howard, to your point, was where he really focused his energy. The earlier case was similar, but it had nothing to do with our Howard University community here. He would then engage them using these social media sites that were not sanctioned by the university, and be clear about that, but were appealing to the university community, and particularly those that were trying to facilitate younger people new to the campus, events you could go to, things you could do, things you could see, where to go get something to eat, those sorts of things. And then he would engage. They would eventually lead to a place where they would set up a date, and then during the course of that encounter, they would be offered something to drink. Some individuals have given us information that he would present that and they would continue to refuse it, and then the bad thing didn't happen. But in other instances, they did drink it, and then after that, there were periods of unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm. And really, he drugged them.
It was during that period that they were transported from wherever this began out to New Carrollton in Prince George's County, where these crimes would take place.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski. If you have a question for the chief or a comment about public safety or law and order issues in the county, please give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810.
Harold, can I offer one thing? As you are doing that, I want to make certain that I do say to the community, it's important, if there are other individuals out there who believe they have information about Julian Everett, or God forbid you are a survivor of an incident, we really do need to speak to you. And the number for that is 301-772-4915. It's a dedicated tip line associated with this case, 301-772-4915.
Why wasn't he prosecuted in 2005 for the allegation of the sexual assault of I believe it was a 16-year-old?
So that case was not prosecuted after review by our detectives, and then in conjunction with the Office of the State's Attorney. They felt there were some failings, but what I'm proud of is that you come forward to 2018, our detectives, working with the leadership of the current state's attorney's office, were able to look at that case again through a different lens, using forensic sciences to our advantage. And that is one of the cases that we have charged contemporary. As to the failings in that case back in 2005, let's just be clear that our capacity to use forensic evidence to our advantage was not the same then as it is now. And then there were some other failings, but we have, again.
What other failings?
Well, and what I don't want to do is get to a place where we're talking about events in the past that were different decisions at a different time. What I want to focus on, and again, different administrations, different state of affairs. Our technology wasn't where it was, where it is today back then, but we have been able to move forward with that case today in conjunction with these other cases.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. We have Ubi on the line in Rockville. Ubi, stay with us. We're going to answer your phone calls after this very, very brief break. So please don't hang up. You will be able to hear the program. And again, if you believe that you have information about the suspect, Julian Everett, you can call at 301-772-4915. And of course, that information, that phone number will be posted on our website tonight after 9 o'clock on WHUR.com. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. But this conversation continues on Sirius XM channel 141 at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking to Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski about law and order, public safety in Prince George's County. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ubi, I believe that's the name, calling from Rockville. Ubi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good evening, Chief. I was wondering, has your department or Howard University considered passing out those kits to the students or to the public at large? It's a date rape tester that you put it in your drink, and if your drink turns a color, you can tell that someone is attempting to drug you. And it may have not helped the victims in this case, but, you know, it's something that people could have just as people carry mace, you know, to aid them when they're out on these dates.
So I think anything that our community can do to protect itself is a good thing. My concern with what you suggest, however, is that there are a host of different substances that can have an effect such as the one I described earlier. And if the testing mechanism doesn't detect that, then the individual could be under the impression that that's now a safe beverage and they could be misled. What I'm going to say is that if you are out with friends, look, I don't want there to be fear. One of the biggest challenges I have is mitigating fear. I don't want the young women or the young men in the university community or in the county to fear engaging with one another, going out, having a good time. But what I'm going to say is this. When you don't know a group of people that you're just becoming associated with, or even if you do and you're in a large crowd and there are other people around, just make sure that you see what the bartender puts in that glass. You see that the beer you've ordered is opened and handed to you. If you control the beverages that you take into your possession, then that's the biggest thing you can do. And when it comes to these sort of test kits, again, if you want to look for those and participate in those kind of things, that's fine. But my concern is that there's a broad spectrum of things that can have that kind of response. And that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't a contaminant in your drink. But if you manage the beverages that you receive or the food that you eat and are particularly aware of those issues, then I think you can make yourself safe in those circumstances.
Ubi, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Brenda, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Brenda. What's on your mind?
Hi, Howard.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Calling because I'm wondering whether the PG County Police Force has considered or has engaged in any cultural sensitivity training. As somebody who grew up in the D.C. area, I remember particularly brutal incidents associated with the arrest of African Americans, and I myself have even seen an incident in Bowie where I was in a restaurant and the police just literally came in and harassed an individual simply because they looked slightly different. They weren't doing anything, absolutely anything, except, you know, eating. And so I'm just wondering whether there is any plan or whether you have engaged in any cultural sensitivity training. I know that in the D.C. police force, they've been getting some classes at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and I just wondered whether your police force was doing something similar.
Chief.
So we've done a number of things, stemming back to our experience with the Department of Justice Memorandum of Agreement and Consent Decree, which allowed us the opportunity to make our training more contemporary, to address some of the issues that you're speaking to, also to be more thoughtful about the use of force. We've increased the number of less lethal options should we have to use any kind of force, so that it's not a forced choice. Like when I became a police officer in 1992, you had very limited options. Now, specifically with respect to your concerns, we have partnered with the Department of Justice and produced a video for the community around issues dealing with the trans and that community. We're working with the autistic community. And then narrowly and specifically to the issue that you speak of, in 2016, we began training all of our recruit officers around the concepts of implicit bias. We got Dr. Chris Marsh, a sociologist with the University of Maryland, to provide that training to those officers. And then in 2018, I expanded that training. And so during 2018, every member of the department went through the implicit bias training up to the rank of lieutenant. And then we're looking this year at training for senior executive staff. They were familiar with the concept. And then Dr. Marsh and I, frankly, it's serendipity that you should mention this, are having a meeting tomorrow morning to talk about the next iteration of that training in 2019, which will begin here shortly. In-service doesn't start until after April in our department, and then it runs through the rest of the year. So the answer to your question is short, yes, and those are some of the ways that we've sought to address that.
Brenda, thank you so much for your phone call. To that point, as you know, the lawsuit, the racial bias lawsuit of more than 10 officers is still ongoing, against the Prince George's County Police Department. While the legal part of that is still kind of up in the air, what have you been able to do to kind of address some of the foundational issues that these officers are bringing up, that they are, that the department is biased against officers of color? You know, particularly, a lot of people may find this ironic because Prince George's County is a majority-minority county. Mm-hmm. And so for some people, that just doesn't seem to add up.
So it's a majority-minority county, as you say, and I lead a majority-minority police department. And what I did at the beginning of my administration was to look at some of these issues. One of them would lead to the implicit bias training that I just spoke of. Let's also talk about the fact that I worked with the union to begin publishing discipline quarterly so that people would understand that there were consequences. In a department as large as mine, the rumor mill can create stories that aren't true. They're not based in fact. So the union president and I worked together to begin publishing that discipline quarterly so people understood that there were consequences for these actions. We have to be careful about that, though, because we're limited with respect to personnel law as to what we can release, but we do publish that. And then I convened a panel before these things emerged in the public space to look at these issues internally. Now, our prior inspector general was appointed a judge. He's no longer with the department. So I took my time to find a new inspector general, and now we're having a conversation about how to reinvigorate that. Now, as you say, in the current context, this lawsuit is now ongoing. And with respect to the specifics, with respect to the individuals, with respect to all of those things that are concomitant to that, I'm unfortunately not able to speak because it is part of pending litigation.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I did want to, since that caller brought it up, I wanted to dip into that just a little bit. But I do want to go back to the Everett case. Since the phone number has been put out, what kind of phone calls have you received in the 2 weeks or so since this case became public? And what have you been able to do with them? Have you received any good leads about more information beyond the two alleged victims that were mentioned?
Well, preliminarily, and I can't go into a lot of detail because I don't want to jeopardize the ongoing investigation, but I can tell the community that it appears that we have two additional victims that we will likely be moving forward with charges with respect to Mr. Everett. And then, again, 301-772-4915, we've received a number of other calls. Those are in various states of investigation, but we've committed the time and the resources to making certain that if there are additional survivors out there, we need only to speak with you. And we have, trust me, the most committed, the most professional individuals, sensitive with respect to the nature of these allegations. And what I will say to potential survivors out there who might be hearing this or might be aware, someone's a friend or a loved one of someone who might be aware of this, the most difficult part can be coming forward. And we stand ready to receive them, to not judge, to find a method and a mechanism by which we can attain justice. And then we have a host of support mechanisms that we can also offer to those survivors. And so it's not just about the case, but it's about setting that individual on a course to recovery. And we have internal resources, and then we have referral resources that we can also provide to help along with that process.
So you're saying you have possibly two more victims?
I'm going to say, for the purposes of our conversation tonight, that we've identified what we believe to be two more victims, and it appears that we'll be able to make cases in two more. And then beyond that, we're still investigating, and I'm here tonight mostly to focus on that. And to speak directly to the Howard University community so that you can be assured that we're working vigorously to make sure that we attain justice for all the survivors, but also to say it's bigger than that. It's not just about these cases. It's about helping people on a road to – it's a difficult thing to say recovery. I don't think anybody ever recovers, but there are ways that an individual can be restored and allowed to begin to cope, and we want to help in that process too.
Are these students? Are these Howard University students? Are they outside the Howard University community?
So I'm going to respectfully say that we're going to hold off on providing additional information about that because we're not sure how far that's going to extend into what communities. But when I do have conclusive information about that, I'll come back. I'll provide it to you. I'll tell the community as I always do. But right now, it's a little preliminary in terms of how these cases are falling together. But I am confident, based on the briefing I received today, that we will have charges with two more individuals.
When do you think you may charge Mr. Everett with that?
So probably within the next 10 days or so, I would say.
How would you characterize Mr. Everett? Because even going back to 2005, and so we are talking about approximately 13 years or mm-hmm. so. How would you characterize the allegations against this kind of person?
Well, this is, I think, for my parents out there who have young men and women who are approaching college age, I think these are the most disturbing sorts of allegations because you have a sophisticated individual who has a method. And it's about how they are able to bring down that defense, how they are able to make that connection that leads to the opportunity. But what I'm going to say, and again, always with an eye towards prevention, always, always, always with an eye towards prevention, for those parents and for the young people who may be listening, right? Even if you're at Howard University right now, I saw some young men and women walking up the sidewalk as I was coming in. You're going to a party. Have control of those beverages. Have control of what you eat. Even if you're amongst a dozen friends, but you're in a party with maybe two or three dozen people, right? You don't know who's doing what. Don't live your life in fear, but just do the simple things of making sure that if you've asked for a beer, the cap is taken off in front of you. If you've asked for a mixed drink or something like that, watch the bartender make it, right? And then once it's in your hand, you keep it in your hand, right? And do those sorts of simple things to protect yourself. The young lady called in about these testing mechanisms. Maybe, right? I said there's a lot of substances that can do a lot of things to people. I wouldn't want you to test a drink and it's fine, and then there is something in there. But the simple way that parents can emphasize this to children and children can take their control of their own safety is to just make sure that whatever you're ingesting, you know where it came from and you've had track of it the whole time.
Something happened actually here in the District of Columbia over the weekend, and I want your opinion of how this should be handled. And I'm not looking for you to give an opinion about how D.C. handled this, but you probably saw it. There was a viral video. A 10-year-old was accused, along with three other teenagers, of robbing somebody of their cell phone. The 10-year-old was brandishing what was considered a BB gun. The police handcuffed him and put him gently into the back of a squad SUV to have him taken downtown, for lack of a better term. There has been concern about the handcuffing of a 10-year-old black boy, but he was handled gently. Okay. Mm-hmm. How under those same circumstances, what do you tell your rank and file officers? How do you handle a child who is accused? And I'm not just talking about a juvenile, I'm talking about a child who's only been on the planet for 10 years. How do you advise them to handle a child accused of a violent crime?
There's an awful lot to unpack there. And one of the things that often gets overlooked in these circumstances, and again, to your point, Harold, not to comment on how my colleagues in MPD.
Yeah, this isn't about, and no passing of judgment about whether they did or did not. I think the optics are difficult for parents, mm-hmm, or just anybody walking the street.
So the public trust is the thing that I always consider when I am in the process of making decisions, right? And the metric is very simple for me. If I make a decision, can I stand up in front of my community? Can I sit here with you? Can I go in front of the television cameras and explain that and provide a rationale that my community will accept and say that makes sense? So let's look at it from the perspective of the victim, right? The victim, you described this as a BB gun. Do they know that, right? So they're the victim of a violent crime, and they don't know that their life wasn't in jeopardy. And we've had instances where it wasn't a BB gun. When it comes to the taking custody, you know, we expect there to be restraint. If there's physical resistance, and again, I want to be clear, with respect to the men and women who do this job here and around the rest of the nation, we do encounter young people, old people, surprising people who offer resistance and can pose a threat to those officers. So what I am proud of is the fact that my officers consistently engage and use measured force to overcome that resistance, and then it stops. Right. And then there's a handful of instances where that doesn't happen. You've seen me again in front of those television cameras with the state's attorney talking about what we're going to do about this. This is inappropriate. But I don't want the community to believe that because a police officer has to use force and engage in that way, that something's wrong. That individual has not left that professional police officer in a place where they have a different decision, and they have an obligation on behalf of that community to take that person into custody. Now, in terms of the handcuffing piece, when you have someone in custody, now we're responsible for their safety, right? Now they're in a police vehicle. We're traveling along the roadways. If that person should become violent, if that person should strike the officer, we don't have cages in our car, so I can't speak to what that policy would be here. If they attempt to exit that vehicle while it's in motion, if they start kicking out windows, we've seen this time and time again. People get in there and they start kicking out windows, and now your vehicle's in motion. Even if you're stopping, let's go back to that thing about seatbelts, right? So it's about controlling. It's not about subjugating the individual. That's not what handcuffing is. Handcuffing is restraining that individual who is in custody for a lawful reason until such time as we can get them to a facility where we can deal with them safely and professionally. And then there are consequences, right? There's charging, there's interviews, there's interrogation, whatever might come down that process. And so handcuffing is not subjugation. Handcuffing is restraining a person for a lawful purpose until such time as we can get them into an environment where we can make certain that they and the people who now have to do those police-related things that we talked about can do that safely. And then at the end of it, you know, often these conversations evolve in such a manner that the community is not part of that conversation. It becomes this interaction between the police and the suspect. Well, again, and I don't know the particulars, and I'm not speaking about my partners in D.C.
Exactly.
But what I hear from my community is, hey, wait a minute, right? I'm scared. I was put in fear, right? I expect... And let me conclude it this way. I have had the opportunity to speak about these issues around the world now, quite literally. And what I'll say is this. We've worked hard. You know, coming back to that question that the nice caller made about our training, right? We've gone to scenario-based immersive training. We've brought in thinkers on these issues. We haven't relied upon police officers to provide this training to other police officers. We've brought in credentialed professionals to begin to look at our culture and to provide training appropriate to our community within the context of our culture. And so that's how we're evolving those issues. A lot of individuals in policing in America right now believe that what the community wants is credibility. And what I'm going to tell you is that that's the first metric that the community now applies in policing in America. And I think it's a very good thing. I think it's a very good thing that when we see misconduct and then abuse by police officers, that that's still a news story, right? Because that tells me it doesn't happen frequently enough for it not to catch headlines. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing for policing in America. I'm proud of the fact that since I became the chief on two separate instances during my 10 years as chief, and it's only been 3 years, the peers have reported the misconduct, right? And we know about both those cases where those officers now face criminal charges. But the peers reported that. That speaks to a healthy culture of police accountability in Prince George's County. But that said, the public needs to know that we're doing this work on their behalf. Mm-hmm. We endeavor to make them safe. And we can't lose sight of the fact that these men and women have a difficult job, and their safety is as important as the safety of the community. And that's why we have specific procedures. That's why we have specific protocol for the handcuffing of individuals, for their safety and for our safety. And at the end of that process, right, we intend to do that in a way that respects the dignity of each human being, understanding that we have a responsibility that's different from anybody else.
One of the other things that has come up over the past couple of weeks, you've spoken about this, the county executive has spoken about this, about property crime, specifically about vehicles. And that's one of the more difficult things that your department is addressing. What's happening with vehicle property crimes right now?
We talked at the beginning about the way that my community is evolving, right? And again, for those who may not know, I'm not from someplace else. I'm born and raised in Prince George's County. I'm very proud of my home. There was a time when Prince George's County was a violent crime community. That was what everybody talked about in Prince George's County, and those days are gone. Where we look now to evolve our strategies and to evolve our allocation of personnel is that those issues that are impacting our community disproportionately. Last year, we had 9,129 property crimes in Prince George's County. Now, when we started down this road almost a decade ago, we had 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 crimes in Prince George's County every year. Last year, we ended the year with 16,099. Okay, so we went from 103 crimes every day. Last year, we ended at 44. As we sit here today, we're at 36. And so the reason... And again, I have so much respect and appreciation for our county executive, formerly our state's attorney, who understands these issues in a fundamental way. We had a conversation. We're talking about this issue because it's impacting us. And one of the things that the community may overlook is the fact that, yeah, it's property crime. Yeah, they broke in and they stole this or that. But if they break that window, now your vehicle's damaged. potentially long-lasting damage to your seats and different things like that, if those are things that are important to you, you've got to make a claim with your insurance. This is potentially going to impact your premiums. Now you got to take a day off work to get that fixed. So it's not as simple as they just took something of minor value. And then what I've been doing is making a point of going to community, and so has our county executive, and talking about this. And what I'm going to say is this. If you went to the bank and they were giving away gym bags, if you went to an event and they handed out, you've seen them, you know, you've got your device there. It looks like it might hold the device, but it's actually just a writing tablet. And you've got that sitting in your dash. If you've got a cup holder and you've been through the drive-thru and you just drop your change in there, that's, to you, maybe not something of consequence. But to a person who spends their time just walking through parking lots and then taking what they see, right, they're going to make an effort to get in there and get their hands on that. And the worst part is they'll break a window, they'll get the bag with nothing in it, and then they'll drop it and walk away. And now you're still in the same place. And what I'm asking is that we take those bags, and if you're going to keep it, put it in your trunk. Put the change away. You know, if you put it in your purse, if you take it in the house and put it in a jar, whatever you're going to do, but just don't leave it in plain view. If we do these simple things, then we can reduce this number further. And in the long term, one of the things that the county executive is very invested in is building our commercial tax base, right? Bringing more business and different options to our community. And some of the costing associated with that has to do with these insurance premiums. And so that's why we have a focus on this. In the long run, mitigating the impact on community of these sorts of things, which the gym bag cost you nothing. It was giveaway. But the window, the day of work, all of that, this can quickly lead to thousands of dollars for the individual, and then you spread that across my entire county, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars over the course of a year. And that has an impact on people's real lives. That's why it's important. And again, it can be prevented. And that's why we're taking that approach this year in 2019. At the beginning of the year, we started by focusing with having the district captains. We have a major and a captain in each station. Having the captains take a specific look at this and make a difference in their respective areas of responsibility. And then we set up a special group to address a more sophisticated kind of property crime dealing with tires and rims and airbags. And we're seeing quite a bit of that. But we're having quite a bit of success with that, and it's only been in place for about a month now.
You mentioned earlier that Prince George's County is growing, and certainly anecdotally, I would say that that is an absolute fact. But let's talk about one big fact that came up just a couple of weeks ago. An organization that does research and the like said that 20,000 African Americans have been displaced from the District of Columbia as a result of gentrification. And those since 2011. And the lion's share of them are believed to have moved to Prince George's County. For the sake of argument, when you've had a minimum growth of some 20,000 people just moving from the district, many of them working class, some of them poor because they cannot afford to live in the district, what impact does that have on your police department?
So from a capacity perspective, right, additional individuals living in our community means that there's potentially a greater demand on our services, right? But our answer to that is to be thoughtful about where we put our facilities. And I think I've spoken about this with the audience before. Those police facilities are put where they are as the center of gravity of response time. You put it in those population cores. You get the benefit of high profile, high visibility, but you also get reduced response times because the police facility is closer to where everybody lives. So there's that issue. I had a conversation with a group the other day about this, the evolution of Prince George's County, the urbanization of Prince George's County. And let me be very clear with the community about that. It's got nothing to do with your socioeconomic status. It's got nothing to do with how you look. It's got nothing to do with who you love, right? Those things aren't the metric by which we begin to size up our challenges or to deploy our strategies. And I don't know those statistics, and I love coming down here and spending time with you, mm-hmm. but I will not pretend to be a subject matter expert on our District of Columbia, and mm-hmm. I have a lot of respect for the leadership here. But with respect to us, we have seen that population growth, but we've also seen crime continuing to decline year after year after year after year. And like I said, last year we ended up with 16,000, and right now we're behind that number. So we endeavor to put strategies in place that focused on where the greatest return can be. Where can we structure a specific response to an emerging problem, the one we just talked about is property crime. But a couple of years ago, we did the same thing with homicide. We did the same thing with robbery. One of the challenges we're having is that as the hashtag MeToo movement has evolved, right, we've seen law changes and we've seen increased demand on the investigators who handle sexual assaults. So we're looking at how we resource that.
Do you have enough officers to handle?
No.
Yeah.
No. But what we do have is the ability to judiciously use overtime, right, to put strategic programs in place to meet the demands. You know, some of the concern in my community centers around MGM, FedEx Field, different things like that, right? Those officers are working on an overtime assignment, and those dollars are being reimbursed to Prince George's County for those officers who are working those assignments, as has been the case since the relationship with those entities began. And we're looking at that as a model for others. Those officers are not being taken off the streets of Prince George's County, protecting communities to go and do that work. That's one dynamic that I want to be clear about with my community. The other piece is we're doing some of this through what I call extraordinary efforting. And that's where officers are working their shift, and then they're coming back and they're working some overtime out on the street. I want to reduce that so that we have a complement that will allow those officers to come in and work a single shift and then go home and spend time with their families. This is a stressful job. This is hard work. I love public safety people. But at the end of the day, I have an obligation to make sure that they can balance, and that's that work-life balance, and then have opportunities to do exciting new things in policing, which is why if you're interested in a career in law enforcement, Prince George's County is the place that you need to look at first.
I'll let you have that plug, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Chief Hank Sawinski with the Prince George's County Police Department, thank you for coming in. Good luck, and for you and the rank and file, be safe.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Monday, April 1st. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.